right, so we're just going to begin with some introductions, just for a few minutes. All the panelists are going to talk about how they got where they are today briefly, and also why they thought speaking on this panel was important. And also for the student panelists, what are you hoping to do after law school, both in the near term and in the slightly longer term? So, Katie, would you like to start?
Well, hey, everyone. As Marta said, my name is Katie Rumbaugh. I'm a notes editor on the Virginia Law Review. I'm also on the board of the Virginia Law Women. I'm one of the co-chairs in charge of the mentoring program, which, as a side note, we will be rolling that out in the next couple of weeks. So I encourage all of you to sign up for the listserv. There's sign-up sheets in the back. The mentoring program is terrific, and I've gotten a lot out of it, so I hope you all will as well. I guess a little bit of background on me. I worked for 2 years before law school. I was a paralegal at a firm in D.C., and so I knew that D.C. was where I wanted to end up in the long term. As a 1L, went back to North Carolina, which is where I'm from, to work. So that summer I split my summer between a firm and working for a judge. This past summer, I was a summer associate at Sidley Austin in Washington, D.C., had a great experience there. And then after graduation, I will be working in a public interest fellowship for about 10 weeks. It's run through the DC Bar Association and subsidized by my firm. Then I'll be clerking for a year at the district court level, and after that, returning to the firm. And then as far as why I think it's good that we have this panel, I mean, as a member of both the Law Review and Virginia Law Women, I'm so excited that we were able to put this together. Throughout my career in law school, I have received tremendous help from upperclassmen. When I was a 1L, you know, talking to 2Ls and 3Ls, also members of the faculty, and I think that this is a good way to start you all off, get you connected to some of us who have been through the law school process and who are scarily almost finished with it. And so I hope that you will get a lot out of this program, and thank you for attending.
Thanks. Hi, my name is Ann Coughlin, and I'm a professor on the faculty at the law school. I want to join the organizers of the event and welcome all of you here. We are absolutely overjoyed to have you at the law school and to have you at this event. We couldn't do our work without you, and we're really looking forward to having you in our community. I'm going to say a couple of things about my background, but first what I want to tell you is that each of us on the panel, and indeed all of your law professors and other lawyers that you might admire, all of us have been at one time, for me, alas, long ago, sitting exactly where you sit. So I'm looking at your faces and I see a range of different expressions, and I can see myself sitting there right with you. So you're going to hear some things about the hard work that we did and good suggestions we have for hard work that you might do, but we all were once sitting exactly where you are, completely clueless about how this was all going to turn out and feeling a little bit worried about it. So that's one of the reasons why we're just overjoyed to be able to have this open conversation with you. So you may look at us and think that we're sort of models of some sort, and I hope we are. But we once were you, and so there's no question that you can find your way in this profession and be successful in the ways that are going to make you happy. So I went to law school after having studied English for a year in a master's program, and I was really unhappy with the master's program, in part because the reading of these texts seemed remote from real problems in the world. So I went to law school thinking, oh my gosh, I've got to have something to do. And I was, as I just said, completely clueless about how it was going to turn out, about how to study law, about it, how to do anything, about which end was up. So I feel like I'm a pretty good person to give basic advice about the kinds of things that you'll want to be doing and thinking about from the very beginning. I went to law school, I clerked for a couple of years, I worked in practice for a while, I then went and taught at Vanderbilt for 4 years, and then had the great fortune to come here and be a member of this faculty. I am especially thrilled that we're having this event now, because there'll be similar events like this throughout the year. When Sarah Buckley was a first-year student, we had a brown bag lunch sort of late in maybe the semester, the first semester, and she later confided in me that those conversations were really helpful to her, but it would have been better to have them earlier and with a larger group. So that's one of the reasons why I'm here, because we are completely and utterly committed to your success and want to answer your questions and just be useful to you from this day forward.
Hi, I'm Sarah Buckley. I am the editor-in-chief of the Virginia Law Review this year. I am a double who. I went to UVA undergrad and graduated in 2009. After that, I worked in Charlottesville for 2 years for Delegate David Toscano, who represents Charlottesville and part of Albemarle County in the Virginia General Assembly, and was so fortunate to be able to stay in Charlottesville for another 3 years and have been so happy to be at UVA for law school. Last summer, I came to law school because of my interest in environmental law in particular, and last summer, I clerked with DOJ in the Environment and Natural Resources Division, and this summer I worked at Latham & Watkins in DC, which has a great environmental practice, and anticipate doing that in the future. Immediately after law school, I'm going to be clerking for a couple of years, and then hope to return to Latham and embark on my career. I am doing this panel because of what Professor Coughlin said. I went to a Virginia Law Women brown bag, I think it must have been October or something of my first year, and I think it, what Professor Coughlin said really just opened my eyes and really helped me in my approach to law school. And that's because when I came to law school, I was pretty scared. I thought that everyone was a lot smarter than me. I mean, everyone is so incredibly smart. Every professor is so incredibly smart and well-read, and I just thought there's no way that I could achieve the level of success that I had had as an undergrad, and that I think you all probably also found came rather easy as an undergrad. So I came in thinking, well, it's okay. It's a B-plus curve. Like, I can be middle of the pack, and that will be fine with me. But something that Professor Coughlin said during that brown bag, as we were talking about disparities in gender in the top indices at the law school, law review membership, the number one person in the class, moot court, et cetera, somebody said at that panel, like, well, why would I pour all of this effort into getting these trophies when there are other ways that I can experience law school, other ways that I can advance my career? And Professor Coughlin said, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you want to be that person? Why wouldn't you want to get straight A's? And that really gave me the motivation to let myself try to succeed, you know, to make myself not afraid of failing and actually try and grab it. So that's why I'm doing this, and I hope you all will do that too.
I'm Molly Shadle. I'm a professor here at the law school. I teach advocacy and verbal persuasion, which means being able to make an argument in a way that is going to convince people. So I want to try to convince you that what Sarah just said is exactly right, that the more you try to achieve and push yourself in law school, the better off you're going to be. I came to law school really not knowing why I was here at all. When I was in college, I spent all my time directing plays. I went to a master's program to get an MFA in directing, dropped out after a year because I wasn't sure I wanted to do it. Moved to New York, started a theater company with a bunch of my college friends. And after several years of starving and not being able to pay the rent, I decided that I needed another career path. So I went to Columbia really just because I had friends who were already there and I already lived on the Upper West Side. I mean, that was my plan, it was an easy commute. And right away felt completely at sea, really thought, I don't know why I'm here. Columbia is full of the Socratic method, and the way the professors there use it, they will call on one or two students throughout the course of the semester. So everybody gets called on once, but a couple people get called on all the time. And I was one of those people in a lot of my classes. And my theory is that it's because my name was easy to say, because at that time it was Molly Bishop, a lot easier than a lot of my classmates. So I found it to be humiliating. I thought it was I thought it was terrifying. I didn't want to talk. And I quickly thought, all right, I need a strategy. I need to figure out how I'm going to survive law school. And you know, I can't cry in class. There's no crying in law school. So I need a different strategy. And so I came up with all kinds of ways to keep up with the homework, take notes for myself, figure out how I could answer these questions. And you know what? I got pretty good at it. By the time I finished, I was on law review. I could do a job interview like you wouldn't believe. And it was the practice. It was being in those stressful situations and answering the questions. So I graduated, I clerked, I joined a law firm called Covington & Burling and worked in their DC office and also in the New York office for many years, and found that I had no problem speaking up in team meetings, putting an opinion out there, and many of my female colleagues were not as forthcoming. It's really terrifying to speak up if you are the only woman in the room. And I feel like I learned how to do it because of that miserable experience in law school that actually taught me quite a lot. So I went from Covington to the Department of Justice. I was in the Office of Intelligence, which is the office that Edward Snowden has now made famous. We were the lawyers that went to the FISA court to get the secret warrants to let NSA spy on all of you. And then after a couple of years, I got engaged to my husband, who owns a website design company here in Charlottesville. And so I needed a job. And I couldn't do my DOJ job here because it was all classified. You had to actually be there. And so I reached back to my Covington connections. I called up Bob Saylor, who's a faculty member here. And I said, Bob, I need a job. Do you have any Covington work I could do? And he said, no, I have a better idea. Why don't you come to UVA and be a professor? And I said, Bob, I don't think it works that way. And the answer is it doesn't usually work that way. So if you're going to be a professor like Ann Coughlin is, if you're going to teach traditional doctrinal stuff, that's not how it works. How it works is you publish articles, you go to a big conference that happens once a year where you try to get a job with any law school that will take you. But if you want to teach things like I teach, practical things, clinical things, things like that, it can help to have connections. And so I started off really as an adjunct. My first year, I was a part-time lecturer, really, you know, could have been nothing at all. And then they let me also be the director of the Public Service Center. But here's the lesson you can take from that. I kept working. I wrote 2 books. I taught a lot. I finally went back to them and said, I don't want to do the administrative work anymore. I just want to be a faculty member. Now I'm a professor of law. All right, so here's the takeaways that I would give you. So one is, talk in class. Talking in class is really, really great because it will teach you a skill that will get you jobs. If you don't want to talk in class, come take one of my classes and I will help you talk in class. The second lesson is connections. So that's another reason why I want to be on this panel is your connections start right here with all the people in this room, with professors that you're going to encounter. My connections have gotten me great jobs. They will help you too. You got to start networking now. And then the third thing is, don't give up. So this is the sort of lean-in philosophy that you've probably heard Sheryl Sandberg talk about, and the idea that you lean into your career. So when I left DOJ, took an enormous pay cut to come teach here, that was kind of mommy tracking my career. Well, you don't have to just give up. You can take whatever opportunity you're in and decide, you know, I'm going to make something out of this. And if you do, it can turn into something that's pretty fantastic. I got to say, I love my job. And a part of why I really love it is because what I'm teaching is extremely interesting to me, and it harkens back to the stuff that I loved about theater. So if you can find a job like that, a job that jibes with your own personal interests, that's going to be a job that you're probably going to be good at too.
All right, thank you, everyone. So we're going to move on to the hot topics portion of our event.
I want to start with talking in class. Okay.
Here you go. That's an example of what you shouldn't do in class when the professor's talking.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I want to start first. I wanted to add a corrective to what Molly said. When I was in law school, I never talked in class. I think it's important to talk in class, but you can be a big success never talking in class. I'm going to go on the record, even though this is being recorded, and say that there must be something wrong with a law school Socratic method if it's designed to make people miserable and feel humiliated and all of those things. And if you've discovered that that's happening here in your courses, you should complain about it. Don't just lean in, you know, make noise, rock the boat, have a fit. The Socratic method, the Socratic dialogue is for you to help you learn. And I agree with Molly, it's very important to learn to speak. It's important to find your voice, but there are different ways to do it. And I don't want the first years in the audience to think, oh my gosh, I've got to start talking in class, even though I don't yet know a thing to talk about, right? So that was sort of my experience at the beginning, was like, I didn't even know whether the book was upside down, you know, back around. I couldn't read it. So how could I talk in class? And I was a very quiet person. I'm not so much quiet anymore, but you can be a very big success even if you are a quiet learner and find other spaces in which to exercise your speaking skills. In large law school classes, frequently talking can be problematic because the professor's going to lecture or wants just fairly limited, you know, comments from you. So don't blow the talking into class stuff out of proportion. If you enjoy it and you should develop an enjoyment for it, go for it. Go for it early. It's costless. What you say in class is a free place to practice. We are not going to penalize you for making mistakes. In fact, your professors are desperately grateful to you for raising your hands, for answering our questions, for making a good faith effort to participate. So don't try to be perfect. We're just so happy that somebody is speaking up and helping us to fill up that silent 60 minutes, okay? And then, so what I would say, do your best. Listen to the questions, answer, but nothing's gonna happen to you if you make a mistake, right? No one's gonna hear it, no one's gonna remember. So just use this as a place to practice. And if it's not you, if you were like me, more of a quiet participant early on, don't worry about that. Find other places and ways in which you can begin to burst into speech. Because I do agree with Molly, it's crucial to begin to speak somewhere.
Yeah, but Columbia and UVA are very different. You're not going to have that same experience here. It is a really different environment. But I will say, you know, the part where you think, I don't have anything to say, I don't know what the answer is, you probably actually do know what the answer is. So very often the talking in class is that you've been called on. So if you're called on, go ahead and try to answer that question because you've probably got it right. This is where you sometimes will see gender differences. You know, you'll see men in the class raise their hands and say, well, I haven't done the reading, but I think the answer is, I'm not advocating that you should volunteer when you haven't done the reading. I think you should have done
the reading.
But I do think, you know, don't hold yourself back and think, I'm only going to speak if my answer is perfect, if I know for sure that what I'm saying is exactly right, because there really aren't right answers in the law most of the time. If you feel like you have something to say and you hold yourself back and think, well, I'm not going to say it till I can articulate it completely perfectly, then you'll probably never speak at all. And that's a shame. This is the part of this education is a rhetorical education. The more you practice at it, the better you're going to get at it.
Okay, so in that same vein, the first topic is going to be dealing with cold calls and classroom participation. So if you do decide you want to participate and you like that, like I was the type of student that I just like talking, so I probably talk too much in class. So, and this is an answer I'm interested in, like how much participation is seen as like a good amount, and how much is too much, and how much is how little is too little to the point where you're like, oh, I don't know who that person is when they come to my office hours.
Is this addressed to
To begin with, the professors, and I have some questions for the students in a little bit.
Yeah, so and it's going to vary from class format to class format. You're going to have small sections, small classes with 30 people. You're going to have classes maybe with 120. We're trying to have smaller classes, but it was common for me to teach 150 students. And you can imagine that the level of dialogue that you have really varies with the size of the class. You'll have seminars where the whole point is to get together and to talk for 2 hours. So it's a matter of judgment, again, it's something that you'll learn as you go forward. Again, if the professor calls on you, again, my experience in the early days was I was like quacking, you know, like you remember Charlie Brown with the teacher's always going quack, quack, quack. So I would like have this instant out-of-body experience and not be able to understand what they were saying. Just take a deep breath. listen to the question. As Molly said, take a shot at answering. You know, most of us are going to give you plenty of time and space. Again, we're really nervous too. You know, we've got a lot going on. We're afraid of mixing things up, making mistakes. So realize it really genuinely is a dialogue. We're interested in hearing what you have to say. You are on the verge of being lawyers. So listen to the question, answer, and you'll pretty quickly pick up what the dialogue is all about. As for volunteering, I mean, it's a matter of tact that you want to develop. You don't want to sit in a classroom with your hand up all the time. I think, you know, that's just a difficult thing for the professor to do, you know, to constantly be dealing with someone who's got their hand up. And so forth. But certainly you should volunteer, you should find a way to provide interventions at appropriate points. The important thing on this front is the way in which you make friends with your professors is not just through classroom discussion, but through contacts after class. So going to office hours and speaking there and so forth. But the question of how much you talk, how much you volunteer, it really varies. If it's a seminar, you're going to be doing a fair amount of talking, but you want to share the wealth with other people. It's a dialogue. It's a conversation.
Yeah, I agree with what Anne said. I think if you're in a big class, the talking you really should be doing is answering the questions that are asked of you. And there may be times when the professor opens it up and says, what do you think? And he's saying it generally and looking for a volunteer in that situation, go ahead and volunteer. But if you are in a big class and the professor's clearly trying to get through some material, it can really derail things if you've got your hand up in the air because you are trying to get through the syllabus. And I think if you feel like you want to stop the class discussion and ask something, you want to ask yourself, is this actually going to move the conversation forward, or is this some idiosyncratic thing that I'm not understanding, or some, you know, little tangential thing that I care about but that other people may not care about? If that's the case, don't ask it. Go see the professor during office hours to talk about something that's a tangent. Smaller classes, I think, are different. Seminars, the class is going to roll on participation. And so there, I think you do want to try to make an effort to be an involved member of the class, especially if the professor tells you that participation is going to be part of the grade. That means the professor is counting on you to be speaking. I think another thing you want to think about is that sometimes your participation is going to be riffing off what another classmate said. And so you always want to be respectful of other people's points of view. You can disagree with them, but you don't put them down for it. You don't, you know, say it in a kind of eye-rolling sort of way. I think tone is important.
Sarah and Katie, do you have any advice for getting over cold call fear or how you go about participating in class?
So I was like Professor Coughlin my 1L year. I hated the thought of speaking up in class. Even now, public speaking makes me very nervous, which is why I'm obviously perfect for this panel.
She's leaning in.
But I think if you are like me and you are very nervous about raising your hand and speaking up in class, the best thing that you can do is just force yourself to do it. Not over and over again, not, you know, to the point where you're being obnoxious, but the more you do speak up in class and the more you do speak out in group meetings or, you know, other situations in the law school, the more you'll become comfortable with it. And who knows, maybe you'll find yourself giving advice to a group of 1Ls one day. So I think the biggest thing for me was just practicing it and forcing yourself to, you know, tamp down your fears and realize that you don't sound like an idiot when you speak, and even if you do, no one's going to remember it a few days later. So feel comfortable in doing that, and I encourage you all to try to put yourselves out there that way.
Yeah. My biggest advice for dealing with cold calls is class preparation. Mm-hmm. I think for me as a 1L, my highlighting and briefing strategy was really key to being able to deal with that moment that they call your name and you forget everything. So we might get to this later, but my sort of strategy as far as class was I used the different color highlighter technique in the book, so each color signified a different part of the case. But I also always had a case brief, which was both a great opportunity to review the reading that I had just done and put it in my own words. And it was another place that I could look down immediately and try to figure out what the professor was saying. And then I think the other big piece of advice is that remember that it's a conversation, and that as much as you feel put on the spot and threatened, the professor is not trying to threaten you. The professor is trying to use a conversation with you to advance the discussion or to help illuminate something for your colleagues who are also just as confused as you are about the point. So if you don't understand what's being asked, say that you don't understand, ask them to repeat the question, say, I understand this much, but I don't know this much, or I think this is right, but try not to always put your answer in the form of a question with the trailing up bit, which is something that I tried to focus on because I know that that's something that women tend to do a lot. And also if you really don't know, like don't get, and you feel like you really screwed up, don't get stressed out about it. Try to forget it. And if it's something persistent that you don't understand, that's an opportunity to go and talk to the professor or talk to your classmates afterwards and try to figure it out. But I always felt like I was on stage and that everyone was watching me when, I think I actually read this in your book, when everyone else is just really glad that their name wasn't called.
Yeah.
So you're not getting scrutinized, and do what you can to understand what the professor is trying to get at in through the conversation.
Yeah, and you'll want to be mindful of the student norms on this front as well. So, you know, again, as I mentioned, from my perspective, you know, I'm nervous. I'm asking questions, and I don't understand why you all just don't go, you know, I'm paying you what? How much money am I paying you, you dummy? I mean, what am I going to do, right? I can't punish you or harm you in any way. I'm just desperately hoping that somebody is going to throw me a lifeline and speak to me. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not completely, right? So from the professor's perspectives, I want to be clear, many answers, all questions are useful or helpful. And frequently, if someone, a student may ask a question that he or she thinks they're way off in left, it's because I've wandered off into left field. I've lost the thread, and someone helpfully asks a question that brings me back. So from our perspective, we really need, we value, we want your participation. And yes, if you say something that's less than perfect in our view, we'll find a way to fix it. You just got the ball rolling. So we're deeply in your debt. But there's another set of norms. So our norms are to encourage participation unless we're lecturing, and then you'll know she's lecturing. She's not asking questions. She's not calling on anybody. You'll know if your hands are up and I'm not calling on you. You pretty quickly get the message that, you know, participation is not the order of the day. But there's norms among students as well. You have names for each other. The people that talk too much are typically called gunners or something along those lines. And those are norms that I really urge you to be thoughtful about, just in general, but then also in terms of sex differences. The dialogue is helpful because the answers that you give are interesting and correct. So if I ask a question and someone answers it, there's the answer. I don't feel like I need to repeat it. So you need to have heard what your colleague said and write that down and realize there's the answer, right? Just because it's not coming out of my mouth, it's coming out of your mouth or her mouth or his mouth, right? So you want to be very respectful of each other, right? And be careful of the gunner norms, and not diss the people who are speaking too much. I mean, you know, again, I realize some people do get obnoxious and cross a line, right? And you know, when you have to find ways to silence that person or get them to calm down a little bit, you know, whatever it would be. But then the other question is whether there are sex differences, whether men participate more than women, and then if when women do start to participate more actively, which is what we ardently want, right? We want you to participate at the level which you're comfortable, you know, and so on and so forth, whether women are feeling more constrained by the norms among you as opposed to the norms from us. If you notice us doing things in the class that are silencing women while empowering men to speak, tell us about it. We need help, right? Because, you know, we may be unconsciously doing things that you should call us on. But if it's norms among each other, then you're going to have to work on that as well. And that's difficult. It's one of the ongoing projects that we call the movement towards equality for women, right? But your perspectives are valuable. That's why we're doing the Socratic dialogue. Otherwise, we would just lecture, right? So the answers that you're giving are valuable. You want to be respectful of each other's comments. And then really be looking to see whether there's a double standard that's being applied. I don't know, but I fear that sometimes, certainly in the past, there has been.
On that note, another thing that really motivated me as a 1L was talking to, I think it was at a Feminist Legal Forum event, where someone pointed out the empirical data that women tend to raise their hand less in a class lecture or in a situation like this. And just taking that on as a personal responsibility, that when I thought I knew the answer, or I thought I had something to say, not waiting to make sure that it was perfect, but making sure that I was keeping engaged with the class and contributing my voice to the class, I sort of used that as a personal philosophy as far as volunteering. And also on a volunteering note, my sort of rule was that I would try to participate fairly frequently, but not more than once a class or not more than once a week. And if I ended up raising my hand, it was usually because there was a dead, awkward silence and I really just couldn't stand it. And I was like, no, I know people in this room know the answer and nobody is raising their hand, so I'm going to go for it. The
professor will be very grateful if you do that.
Oh, yes.
All right, let's move on to tips for 1L exam preparation. I think that's probably what everyone's most interested in. So I know it's early in the semester. We're not trying to scare you, but I personally spent a lot of time just wondering where to begin, what to do. You hear all sorts of different advice and random anecdotes about what someone did who did really well. So I just wanted to get some very concrete as possible advice from the panelists, both from the professor perspective who grades these exams and also from students who have done well, about just what they did, and also especially from the professors, just really try to be concrete, because a lot of what I got was do what works for you. And I'm like, I've never been to law school before. I don't know. You know, you only get two shots. And I'm not trying to stress you. Let's just go. Okay. All right. Anyone can start.
Well, so from a student perspective, what I did, I think Marta asked us to kind of think about it month by month. So for the month of September, try not to think about exams. Try to think about getting something out of each class that you go to and just staying on track with that. I recommend, my system was the highlighting and briefing, and I really tried to stay on top of my briefing. As semesters have gone on, my briefing has fallen off. But definitely in my first semester, I prepared briefs for every class, and I thought that was particularly helpful in order to stay on top of the discussion and understand gaps in my understanding versus what we were hearing in class. I would also not recommend using hornbooks this early. I really use hornbooks as a review method during exam period and not for every class. I think that you'll get the flavor of the subject as the professor wants you to understand it a lot better if you pay attention in class and do the casebook and sometimes hornbook reading that the professor assigns. Because I think getting the professor's perspective and understanding that is important to success on their exam.
I'll add on to that. I also brief all of my cases. I still do that. You'll see a lot of 2Ls and 3Ls will stop doing that. I find that it's incredibly helpful, especially towards the end of the semester when I'm going back to make an outline and actually, you know, really, really tamp down and learn things for the exam. It's much easier to go back and see just a one-page long brief of a case rather than having to flip through a big case book. I guess I would agree completely with what Sarah said about now you should be just getting getting familiar with how to brief cases, how to read cases, what the professor is looking for in each class. I will say that I also agree that horn books should be mostly for review towards the end of the semester, but if there's a concept that you're really confused with, and I, you know, I still do this, it may be helpful to look at a horn book to just kind of get the real bare bones concept, like how is this supposed to work? And then once you, if that helps you understand it, then you can go back and, you know, look at your notes from class, look at the reading, and that may help you understand more comprehensively what the professor's looking for. I remember my 1L year, people throwing around like, oh, when have you started outlining yet? I hate that, but people do it. People will get anxious about outlining. I find for me that it's helpful to not wait until the very end of the semester to outline. But it happens. but at least try to keep your notes organized. I think one of the biggest things for me is organization. Keeping up with the reading, keeping up with your notes, keeping them in a way that when you have to go back and look things up at the end of the semester to learn stuff, you can find it very easily. And that just, it may be more work on the front end, but it will save you a lot of headache on the back end.
Yeah, what I have to say coincides very nicely with the comments that Sarah and Katie have made. I think that in the first month, you're going to be really just getting your feet under you and figuring out how to read cases. What does this language mean? I remember looking up lots and lots of words in dictionaries over and over again, and it just taking time to sink in and to absorb the language, to absorb the discourse, to absorb the way in which cases were structured and what it meant to have a holding of a case and so forth. I puzzled for a long time over the distinction between descriptive and normative. Like, I just couldn't understand certain things in the discourse. I think the most important thing that I wish I had known, and it all worked out great, but is that you're going to be tested, particularly in your first year, on the doctrinal content that you're learning. Now, when you're in the class, of course, you're going to be covering a lot of different things. Again, as I mentioned, some of it's going to be that process of osmosis, of learning how courts speak, of learning, you know, all the procedural niceties of things and so forth. And you're also going to be getting a lot of theory and policy from your professors, and maybe a lot of critical evaluation of the cases that you're reading. And that can sometimes leave you puzzled, even dismayed, about what exactly your job is. Your professor may come in and disagree with every single case you read. You know, each of these cases, they're more stupid than the last one. And if you're a first-year student, you're sitting there thinking, oh, well, that's what I'm supposed to be absorbing, is the complete idiocy of each of these opinions. And so that leaves you at the end thinking, oh, what am I going to do when it comes time for the exam? Well, typically on the exams, unless you're in a critical theory seminar or something where you won't have an exam, you're going to be tested on that doctrinal content. So even though the professor may think, say, the law of attempt, I'm just speaking about criminal law now, is foolish the way it's constructed, still in the first instance, for purposes of the exam, you're going to be expected to know the basic doctrinal content that you covered in the course. So dig into that. What is the case for? Why are you reading it? What is the holding in the case? And I do think it's very useful to keep notes, your own notes, as you go forward. For me, what was essential was preparation before class. I briefed all my cases. I did fall off towards the end, but I briefed them all. At the beginning, I had no idea what a brief was, but I tried. I went to all my classes, and that was something that I continued throughout law school. Even when I got busy and later had to play catch up sometimes, I would always go to class to hear the professor's own words. I found it very difficult to rely on lecture notes from other people. And one thing that I want to mention Marta said she wants us to be specific and not just tell you, oh, do what works for you. I think we can be specific and concrete, hence my advice. Make sure you learn the rule in the cases. No matter what your professor is saying up here about the theory, down here you need to know what the law is, and then there'll be room for disputing theory and so forth as well. So I can be specific. But you also do want to know your own strengths and your own ways and styles of learning. I'm a very slow and plodding reader. I read a page, and then I turn the page and I read the next page. And it can go slowly. So I didn't begin outlining until well after the semester had wrapped itself up. I had heart attacks coming back. Our exams were after Christmas. So we got back from Thanksgiving and people were saying they'd outlined. And again, I was like, I don't even know what an outline is. I just barely finished the reading for the day. How could I be doing the outlining for the entire semester? It worked out great for me. I mean, it drove my husband crazy. I'd be sitting on the couch, finishing my studying half an hour before the exam. But that's the way I learn. I go through everything, no stone unturned, it's slow. I hope you guys don't have to follow that method. But if that's your method, don't let other people convince you, you should read a treatise. You can cut through all that. No. Think about the way in which you learn and continue to deploy those skills on the materials that you have here. The other thing that I would say, I absolutely agree, don't think about exams now. Don't get agitated and worried about them now. But of course, you know that this semester is building up towards exams. So I think that you really do want to be thoughtful about how you use your time and don't overextend yourselves. The basic job for the first semester at least, and maybe the second semester, maybe the third, fourth, is this class material that you're being given. Hopefully your professors are correct that this is important material. It's a ton of work. And again, you know how you study best. You know the things that you need to do to stay healthy. And that's what we really want. This should be a happy experience for you. Law school is a huge intellectual treat. Hopefully you'll soon really enjoy this reading and just love some parts of it. You're not going to love all of it, but some parts of it you will really find speak to you. But it's a lot of work. So don't overextend yourself. And just because your classmates are engaged in certain activities, don't feel like you have to go do those same things, whatever they may be. It may be social activities, it may be pro bono activities, whatever. I really feel strongly you should just spend your time reading these cases, figuring out what they mean. And if you don't get it, you can look at a treatise, but come and talk to your professors. You're paying a lot of money for this education, have you noticed? And you should come upstairs, and if something's not clear to you, maybe we've messed up. Maybe we're not being clear. Maybe you've missed something obvious. It'll give you a chance to practice by talking to us in small context, right? Or maybe you don't understand it because it's really difficult. And then it is something that you should focus on, talk to us about. And if it's really difficult, it's likely to be on the exam. So remember, you're expected to know a body of doctrine, plus some additional theoretical materials your professor will be presenting. And that's where the exams are gonna start. They're gonna focus there. So each time you read a case, think about that. What does this add to the architecture of the law in this course?
And I don't know that I have much more to add to what they've already said, but maybe this would be a good time to transition to that topic of what if you did wanna go talk to a professor?
That's great, you can start us with that.
So it's a good idea to go talk to your professors because, especially if you're in a big class, to us you're a sea of people and it can be difficult to actually understand, to remember this individual is different from this one and so forth. But if you show up in my office, I'm definitely gonna remember who you are. But I think before you walk into a professor's office, you wanna think about what it is you're gonna be asking because you'll only get a few minutes of that person's time. And you want the impression that you make to be a good impression. So the students who come to my office who really, I feel like, wow, I wanna help that student. I wanna write a recommendation letter for that student or mentor that student. They're the ones who've been thoughtful about trying to figure out, all right, what is it, why am I here? What is it exactly I'm gonna be asking? And so they walk in, maybe with a couple of notes already written out about what it is they want to talk about. They don't just wander in willy-nilly. So most professors will have posted office hours those are the times when you're welcome to come in. Or they might tell you, I have an open door policy, come in anytime, then fine, you can come in anytime for those people. But if that's not the case, if they've posted office hours and you're there outside of those hours, then maybe what you want to do instead is email in advance and make an appointment so you know you're not sort of just, you know, walking in the middle of something that they're thinking about, you know, that's not you. And then you want to remind them who you are, because most of the professors have a lot of students. And so you want to say, you know, hi, I'm Molly, I'm in your civil procedure class, so the professor remembers you. And then ask your questions. I also think you want to have a pen and paper with you. So very often people will come to my office and they'll have a laptop, and so there's this weird period where they're booting up the laptop, and then the battery's out, could I plug this in under your desk? And, you know. So whereas if you have a pen and paper, then you can write down all the bits of wisdom that I give you, and it makes me feel like I'm being listened to and I'm smart. But you're also still able to look at me, and then we're actually able to have a conversation. So I think that is a better way to go for something like meeting with a professor, and probably for meeting with a client as well. The same rules apply out in the professional world. Mm-hmm. And then if you've asked for something, so very often the conversation is, could you please write me a letter of recommendation? By the way, if you're asking that question, please don't ask for it like for tomorrow. You know, think about how much time is this going to take, and you know, ask for it in advance. Think about what I might need. So you want a letter of recommendation from me, I need to know, I need your transcript, I need your resume. You know, get all that stuff out there. And then once I've written the letter of recommendation, tell me what happened. You know, let me know, yay, I got the clerkship, I got the job, whatever. Because if I've taken the time to write the letter, then I'd sure like to know how it ended up. You know, I've invested in you, and so I care about you. Your professors can end up being a really helpful professional network. I have students that graduated 9 years ago that I still hear from, and now they're, you know, really into their careers, and I'll help them out as much as I can because they've stayed in contact with me and I know what they're doing. So you want to kind of think about starting to build those connections and keep them up even once you're out of here, even once you've graduated.
I think this is, since we are running out of time, we do have some time to get to Q&A, but to finish up on relationships with professors, and I also, how many 2Ls are here or 3Ls? Okay, great. So just to briefly discuss maybe from the student perspective, I know you both are clerking, I'm clerking as well, like what did you guys do? The process has gotten kind of crazy. What are just a couple tips you have about if you happen to be interested in clerking? It is something to start thinking about just during 1L, because a lot of it is about professor relationships. Just how you went about it and why you think you're successful.
As I said, I'm clerking for a district court judge after graduation. You all obviously have a long time before you need to worry about that, but as a point of reference, two of my three recommenders are professors that I had as a 1L in my mm-hmm. first semester. Mm-hmm. One of my recommenders was my small section professor. I did fine in his class, but you know, I had other classes that I had done better in, but because he was my small section professor, I was able to actually get to know him. I'd been to his office hours, he knew me from speaking up in class, and that he was invested in me professionally. And so that is the kind of relationship that you want to cultivate this, even starting this year, even starting this semester. So step one, professor relationships. I guess my second piece of advice would be think about the kind of clerkship you'd be interested in. And this is true for jobs as well. Start thinking about the kind of job that you would be interested in. And, you know, you hear a lot in law school about, you know, what are the most prestigious firms, what are the most prestigious clerkships, and, it, you know, all of that. And I'm sure they're all wonderful. But what you need to be thinking about is what's going to make you happy in the long run. And so I knew going into the clerkship application cycle that I was interested in trial work. So I limited all of my applications to the district court level rather than the circuit court, because ultimately that is what I want to do. And I think, you know, as I said, you all don't need to be worried about clerkships right now. You don't need to be thinking about jobs right now or stressing about it. But start thinking about what it is that you want to do and what will make you happy in your professional life. Because clerking, from everything that I've heard, it's a wonderful experience, but it might not be right for everyone, for whatever you want to do. And that, I think that is really important. I guess three is a nice round number. So my third point of advice is goes back to what I said earlier. Be very organized. Be very on top of things. Clerkship applications are not difficult, per se. I mean, you need a writing sample, you need a cover letter, your resume, etc. But you have, there's a lot of moving parts, particularly when you have, you know, you're trying to coordinate letters of recommendation going out around the same time as when you're mailing applications. And you just need to be very organized. I think that holds true for most of law school.
I'll concur on the professor point. All three of my recommenders were from some stage of 1L, and they were all professors whose subjects I had really connected with and who I had sought out after class and during office hours to try to build that relationship. So use the tips that we've given you on professor relationships, because not only will it make your law school experience better, it will help you when you're trying to get out of here too. The other thing on clerkships, I think that this is very far off for the 1Ls, is just to think about your writing sample. You can definitely use your LRW samples, but I know for my circuit court clerkship, my writing sample really spoke to an issue that the judge is particularly interested in, and I'm positive that's how I got pulled out of the pile and why that worked out. So. When you're going into your second year, think about taking a class that has a paper or that even has short papers. Mine was only a 10-page paper. And take something that you think you're going to be really interested in that says something about you, because it gives the judge another window into what you're like.
It's difficult when you're a first semester, first year student to think about becoming friends with professors. At least I found that to be tough. It was sort of like, well, who am I? I'm a pipsqueak. I can't speak. I don't know anything. You quack. You know, what am I supposed to quack back? You know, so what I urge you to do is to just brush all that aside and take yourself seriously. Take this work seriously. I don't mean take yourself seriously in the sense of being pompous, but these are three very important years. And as you can hear from Sarah and Katie, the first semester matters a lot. And one of the things that your professors care about is taking ownership of the work. You know, even though you're really new and you don't know what you're doing yet, you will soon. You'll be astonished by the time you're third year how much you've learned and how different you are and so forth. But from the very beginning, take yourself seriously as professionals and realize that in a very short period of time, you're going to be out there in the world doing the work that we're writing about. And our aspiration for you is, just as Katie says, to find stuff you really enjoy that's going to make you happy, and also to be able to practice at a very high level wherever you are, big city, small city, wherever, right? So we're deeply invested in your professional success and your professional friendship, right? So figure that out early on. That it's hard to go upstairs and talk to professors, and it's a little scary and blah, blah, blah. But that's what we're here for, in part. You know, we have a lot of pieces to our job, but we're here to help you get to the places that you want to go. And besides, some of us are nice people, and you really will end up being our friends. And as Molly was saying, it's really terrific for us to have these professional friendships. I've been teaching for a long time, and so I know how much it means. I'm thinking back over the students I've known. But it is also really helpful for you. It's also, again, if you happen to like one of us, it might be fun. We're a friend. But then later, you know, 8 years out, you're going to change a job. You call up Professor Shadle, you call up me, and I know you immediately. And I can pick up the phone and make a phone call for you because I know you, right? And you've got to be part of the initiating of that process. You want to connect with some professors who will know you and be able to help you. It's part of taking ownership of your career as a professional. So I really, really urge you to do that. The other thing, though, I get all the being organized business, but again, I can see, and it is important to be really organized, and oh, you've got to get writing samples, but forget all that for now, right? You will do those things. You will write a great writing sample. You will learn how to organize your clerkship applications. It all comes together. There are people here to help you. So ask for that help. And like Molly, please ask me if you need the letter in a month, ask me today. But if an opportunity arises and you suddenly hear that the clerkship for you just opened up and it's open tomorrow, well, come upstairs and tell me and we'll get the letter out. But notice, you can only do that if you know the professor well. So that's why you should take yourself seriously now. You're one else. We're upstairs. We're in our office hours. We're lonely. Come up. Talk to us. Ask us questions. Give us a context within which to know you. And then we'll remember you, big classes, small classes, and it will move forward from there.